Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. We are here weekday mornings 10 until noon, 10 different topics every week. We try to mix it up, so we hope that there are at least a few that will interest you throughout the week. If you'd like to check on the schedule, listen to past programs, sign up for podcasts, and get other information on programs on WILL Radio and TV, just go to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about Illinois politics. And we have as our guest someone who has been following Illinois politics for quite a long time now, Kent Redfield. He's professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Springfield. He teaches courses in Illinois politics, political campaigns, lobbying. Over the years, he's done quite a lot of research on the financing of political campaigns in the state of Illinois and also the role of money in politics. And we'll try to talk about a number of things, certainly about those things, about campaign finance and about ethics reform, and also a little bit about the budget battle that is going on now in Springfield. Earlier this spring, the General Assembly approved a budget, a $59 billion budget for the state, and sent it on to the governor. The governor, however, said, well, that budget has a $2 billion hole in it, and he says the legislature needs to deal with that, either cut spending or come up with some other revenue. And in fact, he's called lawmakers back to Springfield this week for a special session to deal with that budget shortfall. He is also pushing a very ambitious capital plan to invest money, a lot of money, in new infrastructure development here in the state of Illinois. And it seems right at the moment that no one's really interested in much in compromise and working together. I think that there are some people who follow Illinois politics who say, well, this is yet another chapter in what has been a long battle of wills primarily between two individuals, between the governor, Mr. Blagojevich, and Mike Madigan, who is the Speaker of the House. We'll try to talk about a number of these things here this morning, and of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Our guest, in addition to teaching at U of I Springfield, he serves currently as the interim director for the Institute for Legislative Studies, where he's been a research fellow since 1979. He also has an appointment in the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And in addition, he's director of the Sunshine Project. That's a campaign finance research project that's funded by the Joyce Foundation. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Professor Redfield, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us again.
Oh, certainly.
We certainly appreciate it. I'd like to start to talk a little bit about what is going on right now in Springfield and about the struggles over the budget. And I suppose that some people would say that again, this is – we've seen this for some time now, this dysfunctional relationship between the governor and the General Assembly, and very specifically between the governor and the speaker. It's been pretty intense the last couple of years, and I'm not sure that the relationship between the General Assembly and the governor has ever been very positive. Can you, I wonder, put that in some sort of historical context? Is it really much worse than we have seen in the past?
Oh, I think it really is. I mean, I for better or worse, during the 80s and the 90s and really through the Ryan administration, we kind of developed this pattern of, you know, centralization of power in the leaders, a strong governor, and kind of, you know, an understanding that eventually the leaders and the governor would work things out. That tended to cut members out of the process. It tended to weaken committees over time. Appropriation committees are not nearly as important. In fact, many people say they're completely irrelevant to making the budget compared to what they used to be. But that kind of, you know, there was at least some understanding that they would kind of get done sometime around the deadline and they would make compromises. And, you know, the governor came in after his election and really blew that system up. And we don't have anything to replace it at this point. There's no kind of automatic pilot or kind of to go back to. We're just faced with really what's been an ongoing kind of of three-way fight between the Speaker, the Senate President, and the Governor and the Speaker. So lots of observers in Springfield have been around a long time, have really been shaking their heads because you could almost all of us see how you could work this out, and it's not entirely clear, how we're going to be able to work this out, short of changing some of the faces in terms of who has power in Springfield.
Mm. Well, certainly, you as you say, there's this kind of this three-way relationship or struggle, depending on how things are going on between the governor, Mr. Blagojevich, and Mike Madigan, the Speaker, and Emil Jones, who's the Senate President, And it seems that at least the past couple of years, Senator Jones has thrown in his lot with the governor. And is he in a sense the tiebreaker? Does which way he lean? Does that really depend on who's going to have the upper hand, Mr. Madigan or Mr. Blagojevich?
Well, I think it allows the governor to essentially get a standoff. I mean, there's no question that, although the office of the governor is very powerful under the 1970 Constitution, the legislature could roll the governor in terms of, particularly in terms of the budget. Now, and override him on substantive things. I mean, the governor is, even in his weakened political position, he is still exercises a lot of power within the system. But without Jones as an ally, it would be very difficult for him to get things done. Clearly, the relationship between Jones and Madigan is contentious. Mike Madigan has been head of his caucus since 1980, except for a two-year interruption. He has been Speaker of the House since 1982. And so he is not used to, sharing power, he wants to be treated at least as an equal. And so the governor's position that, the executive was supreme and the legislature was should be subordinate has not set well with the governor, whereas Senator Jones feels like he doesn't get the kind of respect and do that he should, given the fact that he's been leader of his caucus for almost 20 years, 15 years, and Senate President since 2002. So, there definitely are personalities here. It's also institutional between the governor, between the executive branch, the legislative. And so it just, the gridlock seems to tighten, and the weakness of members and the legislature as an institution makes it difficult to kind of, for other actors to kind of go around the leaders and the governor. That just isn't possible.
Mm-hmm. Just one historical point here. I'm curious about what you think. Maybe some people will remember, and I'm not quite sure how many years ago this was, that a proposal was launched, and interestingly enough, one of the chief people behind this was the man who is now the lieutenant governor, Pat Quinn, to reduce the size of the legislature. And I think that some people have argued that in doing that, this weakened the power of the members, increased the power of the legislative leaders, and in fact moved us in the direction of this kind of gridlock that we have seen. And I wonder how much you think that did indeed contribute to conditions as they are today.
Well, I think it definitely is a factor. I mean, when I started working for the legislature in 75, that was under the old cumulative voting system. And there's no question that the House of Representatives was much more difficult to control because it was much more diverse. You had DuPage County Democrats. In fact, the Speaker of the House at that time, Bill Redman, was the Democratic chairman of the DuPage County, which was not there weren't a lot of Democrats in DuPage County back in 1974-75. And then you had Chicago Republicans and a mixture of downstate, that made what happens now, which is the legislative leaders tend to dominate the elections, and that's one of the sources of power. They also, obviously, or maybe not so obviously, they really do have a monopoly over staffing resources, and so the legislature was a more diverse and much more difficult to control, particularly the House of Representatives under cumulative voting. I'm not sure just restoring cumulative voting would, you know, bring back the good old days, if those were the good old days, because you know, part of this trend towards centralization and power in the hands of the leaders and the weakening of the legislature in terms of committees and members, you know, that's a, you know, that's a historical trend that you see in other states, not to the extent that you see it in Illinois. But there's no question cumulative voting made the dynamic very different than it is now.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Kent Redfield. He's professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Springfield and teaches courses on Illinois politics and political campaigns, has done a lot of research over the years on the financing of political campaigns and on the role of money in Illinois politics. He has an appointment at the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and in addition, he's director of the Sunshine Project, which is a campaign finance research project that's funded by the Joyce Foundation. And we're talking some about Illinois politics, and questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I don't know if we need to remind people that the men that we're talking about, the leader of the Senate, the House, and the governor, are all of the same party. They're all Democrats, but that is the case. And I wonder, particularly if you look at this relationship between Mr. Madigan and Mr. Blagojevich, how much their disagreements have to do with genuine disagreements over policy and what course to follow and how the state should raise money and how the state should spend it, and how much of this is personality. It's a personality conflict, and it has something to do with the fact that these two men simply don't like each other.
Well, they don't like each other, and they certainly are rivals for power in terms of who's going to dominate. I think it is also clear that if you look at Speaker Madigan, he is a kind of prototypical Irish Catholic. In the mold of Mayor Daley, a very pragmatic politician, someone who is a fiscal conservative, someone who is a social conservative, and one of the features historically of Democratic politics in Illinois is that it's been very, very pragmatic and very non-ideological. The governor is much more socially progressive. He's much more expansionist. He's less concerned about fiscal responsibility and fiscal prudence than the speaker. In fact, it was quite unusual in Illinois politics, in Illinois Democratic politics, when the governor accused Mike Madigan of not being a real Democrat. You don't usually hear that language when Democratic politicians fight each other. That's quite common on the Republican side in Illinois politics. Illinois Republicans spend a lot of time arguing about who's a real Republican. But historically, the Democrats have been a very pragmatic, power, control, jobs, kind of a politics, certainly reflects, the Mayor Daley. Now I don't want to indicate that's just a Democratic tradition. George Ryan also fits clearly into that tradition, and he's a product of Kankakee County Republican politics, and it's not necessarily just Chicago and downstate, because when I came here, Paul Powell had only been dead about 5 or 6 years, and he was still considered kind of the patron saint of downstate Democratic politics. He was the one with the legendary shoebox full of money, mm-hmm. That was found in his hotel room. So it is, clearly they don't like each other, the speaker and the governor. Clearly they have differences in terms of what they believe government should do. And also the speaker is a con delegate. He has a lot of you know, one of the things he cares about a lot is the legislature as an institution and its power. And so he was very resistive to the governor's assertions that the legislature, was not important, and that the chief executive, the governor was the important actor. And I'm certainly he feels some of the things the governor's done are a threat to the legislature as an institution. So, there the sources of the disagreements between the governor and the speaker are multiple, and they're very deep. That's one of the reasons it makes it so difficult to get compromise.
Mm. Well, you touch on something interesting, and I suppose it makes me think of the controversy that's going on now in Washington over expansion of executive power is the same thing maybe on some sort of smaller scale. Does that apply to Rod Blagojevich? Maybe not so much that he came into office thinking about expanding the power of the governor, but maybe in exercising power in a different way? Maybe it did have to do with expansion of the executive power.
Well, I think clearly, I mean, we should preface this by saying the 1970 Constitution created an office of the governor in Illinois that is very, very strong. It's one of the strongest grants of power to a governor in any state constitution. It was 1970 was pre-Watergate. It was a time in which there was a lot of concern about how American political systems function, and real questions about whether legislatures were really viable, and a lot of feeling that you needed a really strong chief executive or a strong president or governor to make things work. And so we got this constitution that gives these very strong amendatory veto powers and reduction line item of budget veto powers to the governor. So the office in itself is very strong, and then the governor, though, has come in and asserted legislative authority, has not been in the minds of a lot of legislators and the speaker. The governor has asserted executive authority and not been respectful of the legislature's role, at least in terms of the way that the speaker and a lot of legislators perceive it. And so we currently have a fight over, through whether the governor is able to expand health care by administrative rules, what role the Joint Committee administrative rules can play in blocking legislative the way the governor administers laws. Part of the budget fight is about how much control the governor ought to have over allocating projects and allowing particular things to go forward or not go forward in terms of spending. And so, the governor has been very assertive in terms of using the considerable powers that he has. And really there's has not built a relationship with the legislature that might provide a basis for compromise and communication. So it really, it is a constant theme in American politics in terms of the relationships between legislatures and chief executives. And we are at a particularly contentious stage in terms of Illinois politics.
We have a couple of callers who'd like to join in on the conversation, both of them in Urbana. We'll take them in the order they came in, and that means starting with line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Conversation just a bit to election reform. Would you care to give an analysis of instant runoff voting? This is a question that came up in Urbana recently. The mayor expressed the opinion that it had been a failure in California, although I spoke, that is in L.A. I spoke to some friends out there, and they seem to have a rather different opinion.
Sure. What we're talking about here is where you are able to take votes for people who are not in the mix in terms of getting a plurality and apply their second choice in terms of figuring out who would win in particular, if particularly nonpartisan elections. the history of using this is, you know, it's partially a matter of mechanics, which I don't think there are particular problems. It's partially a matter of culture. The resistance to any kind of change in election law is strong in Illinois because, you know, we tend to look at election law in terms of advantages and disadvantages for partisans, for political parties, and for incumbents. And we don't tend to look at changes in election law in terms of what does that do for participation, what does that do for accountability. You know, anytime we discuss something in the legislature, the first question is, does it help the R's or the D's, not does it increase participation or does it make the system more accountable? And so, you know, politicians are also conservative in the sense that they believe in the law of unintended consequences. They may not like the current system, but they know how to win and how things are likely to turn out. And so, you know, I don't think there's anything particular in terms of the mechanics of instant runoff. If they're a problem, but I think that it is hard to get election reform in general, and in Illinois particularly, it is difficult to get election reform given the political culture that we have.
Those who favored it felt that it would open up discussion in politics, probably not make a great deal of difference in who gets elected, but would give some of the smaller parties a chance to express their opinions and play a part in opening up politics.
Yes, and I think that's, I think you can make a case for that. And if that's the values, I mean, it really is a clash of values. You know, is it about opening up the system, increasing participation in voters and parties, or is it about you know, protecting the status quo and the major parties? And that, I think, unfortunately, has been, you know, that's been the dominant position in the decision makers, both at the State Board of Elections in terms of the board itself and the legislature, have tended to, you know, value preserving the status quo and protecting their interest and not, you know, involving risk taking, which, you know, is, I think, is always difficult. So, you know, if your values, I mean, it is really a question. It's a conflict of values, and I think that that's a lot of the resistance to change is, you know, it reflects the fact that the people that control the system, the parties that are in power, you know, are reluctant to share, and the traditions in Illinois in terms of our politics tend to favor the status quo and tend to be anti-reform.
I got a feeling in the discussion at times that the, particularly the Democratic Party, who I usually agree with, felt that politics would be just fine if only the citizens would stay out of it.
Oh, I could, you know, I have to say, when I first came to Illinois, people were talking in the legislature about the goo-goos, which are the good government people, and the plague of women voters rather than the League of Women Voters. And the attitude seemed to be that, you know, politics was for professionals and that, you know, if you weren't involved to protect your job or your uncle's job or someone else's contract, that you know, you weren't serious. If you know that the people that were just interested in participation were kind of dilettantes in terms of what was real politics. Those attitudes are still there, and they die very slowly. I mean, I think we tend to view Illinois politics tends to view it as something that's for professionals, and we don't have instant we don't have same day registration, and we've limited things in terms of voting participation because that increases uncertainty and makes it more difficult to control and protect. Whereas I Personally, I think we ought to be favoring more participation and more involvement. But the game is definitely rigged in terms of the status quo, and you have to get the public to, you know, put pressure on the politicians to understand that, you know, those values have to be honored and not just protecting the status quo.
What other reforms would you see as highly beneficial? After all, we have a state that has sent, what, four governors to the penitentiary, has one in the penitentiary and another may be headed there. It seems as though election reform is needed.
Yeah, and I think participation is, you know, that we really should be encouraging that. I mean, there was a lot of discussion about recall, which adds, overturns an election by having another election. If you look at the participation in terms of eligible voters, not registered voters, we were about 38% in the gubernatorial election in 2004, and so we really ought to get more people involved. A lot of people were complaining about the results of an election, you know, that they seem to have skipped. So same day registration, more mail-in voting, anything you can do to get people to participate more. Then on the corruption side, you know, clearly the pay-to-play bill that's sitting on the governor's desk is a start. I mean, that would be the first time that we have said, here's a situation: contractors giving money to politicians who administer their contracts. Here's a situation where the possibility of corruption or the appearance of corruption is so great, we ought to just ban it. Up to this point, all we've said is, you know, all we need is disclosure. All we need is, that we don't need limits. We don't need prohibition. So certainly hardening the target, making it more difficult to be corrupt, and making it so that we would have less of an appearance of corruption by limits, by banning certain types of contributions. I should say that the Obama phenomena in terms of small donors raises an interesting issue in terms of if we were to provide match for small donors in terms of public funding, if we were to provide tax rebates or tax credits to small donors, then, you know, I mean, I don't think, you know, public finance in elections where you take my money and you give it to a candidate I don't agree with, that doesn't seem to be very popular. On the other hand, if you encourage me to participate to give $150 to a candidate by allowing me to get a tax rebate or a tax credit, you know, that certainly would increase the number of small donors. And one way to deal with big money in politics is to try to prohibit. Another way to deal with big money in politics is to try and get more small money into politics. And if 5% of the people in the state, and it's currently more like about, you know, 1 or 2%, if 5% of the eligible voters in the state gave $150, you would overwhelm the amount of money that comes from the Illinois Education Association or the Med Society or the Manufacturers Association. So, you know, I think we have to think creatively. We need more participation. We need to do something about the role of money, and we need to make it more difficult for corruption to take place. Yeah. Sorry to run on there, but
I appreciate the thoroughness of your answer. I'm sure the caller does too. I need to jump in here. I want to thank him because I have and go on because I have another person who's waiting patiently to join us. And let me just take enough time to introduce again our guest, Dr. Kent Redfield. He's professor of political science at University of Illinois at Springfield. Also has an appointment in the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs. In addition, directs the Sunshine Project. That's a campaign finance research project funded by the Joyce Foundation. He, for many years, has now been doing research on the financing of political campaigns in Illinois and also on the role of money in politics. He teaches courses in a number of things, including Illinois politics, political campaigns and lobbying. And we're talking a little bit about the current state of Illinois politics and how sometimes things change and sometimes they don't. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Another Urbana caller. This is line number 2. Hello. Yes.
Yeah, you were talking about the power of the governor relative to the legislature, and given the fact that Senate, House, and governor are all Democrat, it seems to me that the tiebreaker here is the head of the Senate, and that if he were aligned with Madigan as opposed to Blagojevich, things would be very different in Illinois, and that he has the power to prevent anything from coming to the Senate, even if, like, the total number of the Senate minus himself were for it, he could still block that?
Yes, I one of the things that has happened in Illinois is we've had this huge consolidation of power in the hands of the legislative leaders, and power in a certain sense is zero sum. If someone becomes stronger, someone else becomes weaker, and members have become weaker. And so the legislative leaders tend to dominate their caucuses. It may be hard to find the Democratic Party in Springfield, but you can find the Mike Madigan Party and the Emil Jones Party and the Tom Cross Party, the House Republican leader, and the Frank Watson Party, the Senate Democratic leader, the Senate Republican leader. So, members do not have staff the way that congressmen have. Members, committee chairmen do not appoint staff people. They don't have budgets. All of that is in the hands of the leaders. And so you really do have a problem where the leaders dominate their caucuses. And even when the system used to work where the budget was either the two Democratic leaders and the governor or all four leaders making a budget, it then was presented to the members pretty much as a take it or leave it sort of thing, and lots of legislators didn't know what was in the budget till it got to their desk. So the consolidation of power is a huge issue in terms of the role of individual legislators and the way the system works. It's also fair to note that while you would think the Republican Party could take advantage of the fact that this huge mess in Springfield, it comes to us courtesy of complete Democratic dominance in terms of all constitutional officers in the legislature. The Republican Party in Illinois is at a period right now where it is very, very weak, both statewide and in terms of the caucuses. In spite of the mess in Springfield, observers would not be surprised to see the House, the Democrats pick up a few seats in the House, and the Democrats already have a supermajority in the Senate. So part of the problem here has been the inability of the Republican Party to take advantage of the situation and present an alternative, and also to build their own power in light of what has been really an ongoing disaster in Illinois state government for the last 3 or 4 years.
Mm. Well, again, I want to thank the caller. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, here we are a week into the fiscal year, and we don't have a budget. At least what we can say is the legislature passed one, sent it to the governor, but the governor looked at it and said, look, guys, we have $2 billion more spending here than we have revenue. We can't have that. He wants the legislature to approve some new revenue sources in part so that he can get his $34 billion capital bill funded as well. Legislature, mostly, I guess it was Mr. Madigan all along, has said, no, I don't go for any of that kind of stuff. And it makes it look like he's really trying to back the governor into a corner so the governor will have to make the cuts, and if anybody's going to look bad, it's going to be him. So that seems to be kind of where we are now. And the governor called everybody back to Springfield, but I don't really think anybody thinks anything's going to happen much in the next couple of days. Last year, we went all the way until August before there was a budget. How do you think this is going to play out?
Well, I think it is unlikely that the governor is going to essentially blow the situation up by vetoing the whole budget. I mean, if he were to do that, then we would have difficulty making the state payroll in terms of the 15th of July. There's no question about that. And so the governor, without the support of the Senate president, who really doesn't want to spend the summer in Springfield, the governor is essentially, he's going to try to make his case that we need revenue. That's probably not going to happen. Then he will make – he will sign the budget in part and veto it in part, and that will allow everybody to get paid. There will be enough money there to – for paychecks to go out. There will be some huge kind of draconian cuts. Some of the cuts will be made to kind of extract maximum political pressure and pain. And then we'll come back after the election and start to sort this out. So I don't think the final budget is not going to be set by the end of the day on Thursday. But I don't think there's that without the cooperation of the Senate Democrats, the governor, I don't think, is going to be able to keep the legislature in town and force them to pass a new budget. And so I think the governor will – the speaker with the committee of the whole today will spend – try to get as many headlines as possible blaming the situation on the governor. The governor tomorrow will try to orchestrate things to get as many negative headlines as possible blaming the situation on the speaker. And then we will just go away until after the veto session, at which point we might get some revenue. We might get supplemental appropriations. We might get a very different budget. But the governor's position is much weaker than it was a year ago because of his potential legal problems, his lack of, his bad public opinion polls. Governors can, part of the way governors are effective is their ability to help legislators and hurt legislators politically and in terms of campaigns and things with the state budget. And the governor is just he's less able to do that. People don't want his help, and he can't hurt people as much as in ways that he could before. So I suspect it's just going to be a lot of finger pointing, and then we may get this figured out in the fall. It may be next spring before we really know what the budget looks like, which, if you're a state university and, you've got an increase and then the increase disappears and then the increase might come back, that makes it hard to budget. And that's, all state agencies are going to face those kinds of problems if we really have, a lot of uncertainty over the next, 9 months. Mm.
One question, maybe this is a little on the technical side, but it's something that I've been wondering about. Given that the Constitution requires the passage of a balanced budget, I guess my thought was, does that mean that the legislature is required to pass a balanced budget? Because here, obviously, they haven't. Where does that – who is responsible for making sure that it is balanced?
Well, it says that appropriations – cannot exceed estimated revenue. And while the legislature has been a little more straightforward this time around in kind of being public that, in fact, they don't think that the numbers add up, we have had budgets in the past where where we know that they're underfunded. We have had budgets in the past where everybody knew we were going to come back and do a supplemental appropriation for Medicaid in the following spring for, $500 million or whatever it happened to be. So, the language is loose enough that it's really in the eye of the beholder. I mean, a governor, when he vetoes, often will cite that the reason he's going to veto something is that the Constitution requires it. It's not clear how that's enforceable. I mean, what the courts, if the court would get involved and what kind of remedy they would suggest, I can't imagine the legislature, the state Supreme Court taking it up. They would view it as a separation of powers issue that has to be worked out. So it is, it's a useful guideline, but it has been honored more in the breach than in practice, and often more as a, as rhetoric for, whatever particular position you want to promote.
There has been for some time now been an ongoing federal investigation of political corruption here in the state of Illinois. That is something I'm sure people in Springfield have been following very closely. The last big event probably was the conviction of Tony Rezko last month. He was found guilty on 16 of 24 counts of federal corruption charges, including mail fraud and wire fraud and money laundering. He was one of the governor's top fundraisers. A number of people testified during the course in this trial that that if you gave money to the right people, that it could get you a job. It could put you in a position to take advantage of state contracts and make money. And that has contributed to not only the governor's weakened political position, but this drive to pass this pay-for-play legislation that's unanimously got through the General Assembly. What does all this mean for business in Springfield, the fact now that there's this looming shadow over a lot of highly placed people in state government?
Well, I think if you look back to George Ryan's last year in office, I mean, he wasn't running, so he was a lame duck. I mean, certainly that was a factor. But he had not been indicted at that point. But he became increasingly less and less effective. And this was a person who was an effective governor who had good relations with the legislature. But, you know, people started to run, away from the governor, people in his own party. That's already happening in terms of the Democratic side of the aisle. And so there certainly is the prospect for the governor becoming more and more immobilized by his legal situation. The timetable of the federal prosecutor, Fitzgerald, is his own timetable. There's certainly another event looming, which is the indictment on non-public corruption charges, but they have indicted another fundraiser for the governor, Christopher Kelly, a roofing contractor. And the reason they were investigating him and are aggressively pursuing charges involving business offenses where he was laundering money to pay gambling debts is they believe he can provide them with a route to the governor. The U.S. attorney is clearly organized. I mean, he's pursuing these prosecutions towards, it all points towards the governor. I think people would be amazed if the governor at some point was not indicted. But nobody knows exactly when that's going to happen. That just makes it more and more difficult. I mean, George Ryan, one of the reasons he was so involved with the death penalty in the last part of his administration, besides the fact that it was a sincere public position, policy position, was the fact that was something he could do by his own, that he didn't need to, the legislature to he didn't need to work with them. And so it just the prospect is for a lot of drift. It's hard for legislatures to lead. It's things tend to get done when governors provide leadership, and the governor's ability to lead is severely weakened and may get progressively weaker. So it's not a happy prospect. Now, this could get turned around. I mean, there was a serious investigation, management systems in Illinois, MSI, during the Edgar administration that eventually, the prosecutor lost a conviction and it essentially stopped where people thought that it might get to the office of the governor, not Governor Edgar personally. So, you never say 100%, but it certainly appears that we're just looking at another 2 years of a lot of drift and gridlock because of this situation.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller here, a couple of minutes left. The caller is in Effingham County, so we will talk with them. Line number four.
Yes, on the CONCON, would it be possible to revise that without going to the convention?
It is. The legislature can put a constitutional amendment on the ballot. So the legislature did not pass a constitutional amendment to put the recall provision on the ballot. And if that would have gone on the ballot, been accepted in the general election, if the voters majority would have approved it, then we would have amended the state constitution to put a recall provision in it. So the legislature has the power to put constitutional amendments on the ballot. Citizens do not. I mean, cumulative. There was the cutback amendment that dealt with the cumulative voting and the size of the legislature. But the public cannot put a policy issue or something that doesn't involve the legislature on the ballot. So you couldn't pass petitions and get recall. What CONCON does, if the voters accept it, then we have an election to get a new constitutional convention. The members of that constitutional convention could propose a whole new state constitution, or they could just propose a series of amendments. They could say, okay, we want the voters to vote on recall, on a graduated income tax, and, you know, merit selection of judges. But we could also get a whole new state constitution being proposed. Then you would have to have another election, and a majority of the voters would have to accept either the amendments or the new constitution. So right now, we do this every 20 years. It's on the ballot whether we want to have a constitutional convention. That's coming up in the fall. And if that were to pass, then we would then have elect delegates from each legislative district, 59 legislative districts, I think 118 members of CONCON, then would propose – they could do – end up proposing nothing, but they also could propose amendments to the current constitution or a whole new constitution.
And this is something that it seems to me that there hasn't been a lot of discussion about. I mean, the fact that the question was there, I wonder how many people will go to vote in November and look at this and say, well, what is this? And some might be surprised that it's there.
Oh, I think that's true. And I think that what makes what happened in 1970 so amazing is that – and it was about a 20-year effort to really get a call for constitutional amendment on the ballot and to kind of build a consensus that we had a constitutional crisis. You know, part of the reason that CONCON is getting more attention and people are talking about that we need a new constitution is not we don't particularly have a constitutional crisis. We have a huge leadership crisis in Illinois. And, you know, we probably some new legislative leaders and a new governor, you know, would probably, you know, fix things. So whatever your idea of fixing things is would be a more efficient way of doing it than a new whole new constitution. There certainly is, you know, there certainly is it's getting attention because of the mess in Springfield. On the other hand, you know, the people with a vested interest in the status quo, and we're talking big labor, teacher unions, the business community, you know, there's a broad coalition that's raising money to fight CONCON. You know, pensions are guaranteed, public pensions are guaranteed in the Constitution. That makes teacher unions nervous. There's the income tax rate on businesses is linked to the income tax rate on individuals. So you can't jack up taxes on businesses without increasing taxes on individuals. That 8-to-5 ratio, you know, that could be at risk if we had a CONCON. And so, you know, the business community, sees potential danger there. So anybody that thinks that they might that could imagine things getting worse, you know, probably is going to be in this coalition to fight CONCON. Whereas on the other hand, you're going to get Pat Quinn particularly and other groups that will, think that things can't be any worse for them, and maybe if we shook up the game with a new constitution, things would be better. So it'll be an interesting fight, but right now it's not very high on most people's radar screen, and that will work against it.
Yeah. We unfortunately have just about a minute. Real quick on pay-to-play, the legislature passed this bill essentially that says if you have a major contract with the state, you cannot give a campaign contribution to a state official that is in the position to decide on the contract. And clearly that's influenced by people's concerns generally over money and politics and what's happening now. It's gone to the governor. He said something like, well, you know, this is good, but I think it could be better. And some people, I think, wonder whether if he messes around with it, it'll go back to the legislature, and in fact, it might not pass. It may end up going nowhere. What do you think is going to happen?
Oh, I think that's a concern. If he vetoes it, amendatorily vetoes it, I hope it will be overridden. It is not that this isn't everything you could do, but this is a case where you can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. This is a positive step, and the governor is in no position to lead. He does not have credibility on this issue. He, in fact, is the poster child for why we need the bill, and therefore he's not going to be able to, marshal forces and build a coalition for broad-based reform, even though that's needed. And so I hope he will sign it. If he vetoes it, then the votes are there to override it. But there is always the danger of, killing it with kindness by trying to improve the bill, adding more things on there, and, you could end up losing it. So that would be a shame. It's a positive step. And, the more can be done next session. There's always another year to pass another bill.
Yeah. And anything serious behind a move to impeach the governor?
At this point, it is more posturing. Because impeachment, recall, you're overturning an election by allowing the people to vote again. Impeachment is the legislature overturning the results of an election. And short of an indictment or really much more serious evidence of criminal wrongdoing, I think it's difficult for the legislature to make that move, because you really are substituting the opinion of the legislature for the opinion of the voters. And the voters put Rod Blagojevich in office, and I think for the legislature to remove him is not something you do lightly. I think that that's a very serious, even when Richard Nixon was, all the evidence was there, it was still agonizing for the legislature, for the U.S. Congress, to think about impeaching Richard Nixon. And so I think that's a much better precedent than the Clinton impeachment in terms of the standards that ought to be there.
All right. There we'll have to leave it. Our guest is Kent Redfield. He's professor of political science at the University of Illinois Springfield, longtime observer of Illinois politics. Professor Redfield, thanks very much.
Thank you.